All right, hello. My name is Joshua Faust. I am a fellow with the American Security Project, and tonight I'm going to be talking about Libya with...
Daniel Serwer. I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a scholar at the Middle East Institute.
So, sounds like Tripoli is in trouble now. Daniel, what do you think?
I don't know. I think Tripoli is in celebration at the moment. I wouldn't call it trouble. I think it's. I find this thrilling. I realize that there are very serious problems ahead, but I think the first thing to be said is that this is a great triumph in a certain way for a lot of Libyans, not for all, and I find it quite thrilling to see people succeed at something like this, even if I would have preferred a nonviolent approach.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just what has always been a big question mark in my head about what is happening inside Libya is what is meant to happen in the long term. Even from the rebels and definitely from the international community, I've never gotten a really strong sense of any sort of long-term planning. And I mean, yeah, like it is, I agree with you. It's super exciting to see Gaddafi out of the picture, or at least near to being out of the picture. But what keeps sticking up in my head is what we're going to do next. I mean, I still don't have a really good understanding of that.
Well, I think that's right, that there's not a good understanding of that. Or to put it more precisely, I think some people have a pretty good understanding. Some people want to see, I think everybody wants to see a unified Libya. I think everybody wants to see a more democratic Libya. And I think...
Everyone who? I mean,
Everyone who counts.
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, in the international community, I think that's definitely true. But
yeah, I mean, in the international community, now there are going to be a few...
But ultimately, I mean, this is...
There are
going to
be a few autocrats in Africa who are discomforted by this, and Chavez is going to be discomforted by this.
Yeah.
But with those relatively few exceptions, I think there's going to be some considerable consensus on the direction people would like to see Libya go in. The real question is, can we put that consensus on a piece of paper, pass it in a resolution in the Security Council, and give this thing some momentum in the right direction? And I would like to see that happen. I don't think we can continue with ad hocery much longer.
I would definitely agree with you, and I think actually the big sticking piece in this is going to be the Libyans themselves. One thing that for me, and this could just be because I'm not an expert on Libya by any stretch of the imagination, is that the people leading the revolution seem to be fairly upper and middle class people. And the families that have been supporting it seem to be pretty pissed off that they either lost or were unable to maintain or continue their business holdings under Gaddafi's rule. I don't have a good sense, at least in the reporting that we've seen so far, about what actual Libyans, like the mainstream kind of working class man in the street Libyan, really wants from this, aside from the euphoria of seeing Gaddafi gone. What I would like to see is actually a public debate inside Libya about what the exact nature of their future government is going to be. But I'm not sure how the international community could really play a role in fostering that.
Well, I think we could play a role in fostering it, but it requires a domestic Libyan framework first.
Absolutely.
And I've been involved, in fact, in supporting a somewhat abbreviated and abortive effort to support public discussion of the new constitution in Iraq, for example. I don't think there's any question but that had there been a broader discussion of that sort, that we would have avoided some of the problems we've had. And I think you're right. In Libya, a broader discussion is needed. The problem is going to be that Libyans really want to vote.
Yeah.
And they want to vote quickly. And I've talked to people in the TNC, the Transitional National Council, about this, and they just don't want to hear advice that says, you know, you can wait a while for elections. They are very anxious to push ahead towards elections, and what can I say? I think it's unwise to go too quickly in that direction and wise to do local elections before you do national elections. But it's the Libyans who are going to decide, and I agree that they should decide.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, I think, getting at kind of a bigger issue. You said before that you're kind of sick of the ad hocery and don't see a real future for it. I mean, I definitely agree with you on that sense. The ad hocery, I don't think, is limited to the international community. In a lot of ways, that's also defined the rebel movement. And I think some of the incidents, like that assassination that happened a couple of weeks ago, some of the scattered reports of abuses or rapes or pillaging or reprisal murders against supporters of Gaddafi, speaks a little bit, I mean, not just to revolutionary furor, but also to the sense that the rebels didn't have a long-term plan either, and that you have an international community without a long-term plan, supporting a rebel movement without a long-term plan, and that just seems like it's kind of a recipe for disaster if we're not really careful and really on top of keeping a lid on things.
Well, they have written a constitutional framework, a constitutional charter for themselves that actually goes, in my view, a long way in the right directions. The problem is, you know, some professor sat in a room and wrote it and gave it to the international community, and it sounds very good. Yeah. How much does it actually represent the sentiments of the guys, the teenagers who are fighting for Tripoli? I'm not so sure. That's where a broad public discussion of the future of Libya and how power should be distributed in Libya would be a very good thing at this point. But the first job one is not that. Job one is making sure that there's law and order, especially in Tripoli. That's going to be an enormous challenge, I think.
I would agree. And I mean, I would even start that by asking a pretty simple question, like, what is law and order in Tripoli? Is that just a cessation of violence? I mean, I would...
You ask very difficult questions, you know. I mean, really. You know. Law and order, you know, it's a TV program. you know, the... Yeah, it's a very good question because... you know, there's going to be a big celebration now. Everybody's going to be shooting guns off. Mm-hmm. And you know, some people are going to be shooting people whom they think killed their uncle, and other people are going to be running away with state assets and privatizing them into their own hands, and other people are going to be looking around to see whether there are a few stingers lying around someplace that they can glom onto and sell into the world arms market, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big, tall order to say, you know, restore public order in Tripoli. But you know, if things get very chaotic, if you get a kind of internecine warfare among the rebels, it could really create a big, big problem. And I've argued that it's the Europeans who should worry about that problem in the first instance, because they're attached to this country by pipelines, because they're the ones afraid of Libyan immigrants. But I don't see the Europeans doing a hell of a lot of heavy lifting here.
I don't. And that's been probably one of the most interesting, at least looking only at NATO, one of the most interesting aspects of this war. Not just how, in a way, America was kind of imitating the bad alliance behavior that NATO displayed in Afghanistan by attaching caveats and conditions on its participation, but I think also with how rapidly you've seen a lot of NATO countries, especially Italy, just kind of lose interest in the very war that they advocated so strongly for. I've been, I mean, not surprised, but really disappointed to see that happening as quickly as it did. I mean, this hasn't even been going on 6 months yet, and people are already starting to, at least in Europe, are already starting to throw up their hands.
Well, you know, the Americans have an over-reliance on the military instrument, and the Europeans have an over-reliance on civilian instruments. And, you know, I think we could both benefit from learning a bit from the other. We could use our civilian instruments a little bit more and a little bit more effectively.
Absolutely.
And the Europeans are in desperate need of more and more effective military instruments. But look, we are where we are. You make decisions at the margin. This collapse of the Gaddafi regime is happening much more rapidly than anticipated. That in itself is going to present serious problems. because people, I just don't think we're terribly well prepared for this. And I think the odds of chaos, because Gaddafi has not turned over power.
Yeah.
Had I been an active diplomat in this, I would have worked very hard to try to get a formal turnover of power in some fashion, because that's what prevents the kind of stay behind rebellion that we suffered in Iraq.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think Iraq might be an interesting case in this, at least in the role that the looting in the early days after OIF began. You know, one thing that's been coming out, at least in the research I've been doing for my fellowship, is the real importance of securing property rights as any kind of a transitional strategy from conflict to post-conflict to normalcy, whatever the word is for what comes after post-conflict. And I think in Libya in particular, doing something like the establishment of property rights is going to be one of the more difficult challenges to come across, just because of Gaddafi's refusal to put in place the normal institutions that you would see in a normal functioning society. I mean, something as simple as land ownership, I know, is somewhat more complicated than we would normally give it credit for, but ultimately those are the kinds of issues that are going to be creating stakeholders in the society. It's how they're going to be creating people who have a stake, not just in their own advancement, but also in the advancement of their country. And I mean, in that sense, I think starting from the level that Libya is starting at, we're going to be flying by the seat of our pants for a little while we try to figure out what the best method is of securing things like basic property rights in order to form some kind of a foundation for whatever happens afterward.
Well, absolutely. And it's in that interim period that you're going to get Gaddafi loyalists starting to claim that property that was state property is actually their property.
Exactly.
And that kind of piracy that occurs in these confused situations can be extremely dangerous and prejudice the success of the whole enterprise. And I think if you're worried about where Libya is headed, I think it's a good thing to worry about, because the range of outcomes here is just gigantic. I'm all for celebrating tonight. I mean, people should feel good about what has happened. But it's hard to feel good about the future until we get some basics in place. And I think a UN Security Council resolution is an important piece of the basics that gives the whole international community a sense of direction. This is where we're going. You can even mention property rights in a UN Security Council resolution. It wouldn't surprise anybody any longer.
Yeah. So do you see any appetite in the UNSC for pushing through some kind of follow-up? Because, I mean, if I remember right, the resolution they passed, 1973, that authorized this specifically forbade any kind of an occupational force. I know there are ways to get around it by calling any kind of troops that show up there afterwards as not being occupation. But, I mean, I think there does need to be some kind of international presence there. You know, we've kind of taken on this broken vase, and now we have to deal with it and deal with the consequences of it.
Well, I think the first piece you need is the UN piece. The UN has to have a mission there.
Yeah.
I think the UN will take on the political role for the international community, insofar as it's not handled by individual embassies. The American ambassador is going to be a strong figure in Tripoli. But in addition, my view is that the Europeans should be preparing, should be ready now to put in a police force. I mean, they have several, they have up to 800 or so constabulary forces. They have other non-constabulary police, constabulary police being paramilitary police, essentially.
Yeah.
And I think they should have been called upon to ready themselves long ago. And I'm not necessarily privy to all the diplomacy, but it seems to me that if we didn't raise that question with them, that would be a mistake. They should be ready to help with law and order in Tripoli if it becomes necessary. And, you know, you have to prepare those things well in advance. You don't have to necessarily disembark all the carabinieri to Tripoli, but you have to somehow have them ready to go, and I don't think they are ready to go.
Yeah, and I'd actually one up that and say that sending them is probably going to be a bad idea. And the precedent that I would call on for that is actually Afghanistan. We put Italy in charge of training the police forces in Afghanistan very early on, and it was an astounding disaster. We then put Germany.
But I think they actually, to be fair, I think they were put in charge of the justice system, not the police.
That you're right. Germany was in
and
charge.
And the Germans got the cops.
But
and it was a very bad example. But I'm not thinking now of the training function.
But even then, you know, the biggest issue Europe has run into, the European members of ISAF have run into in Afghanistan, is that they cannot provide enough police to go over there. I mean, they're hundreds and hundreds of police short of their commitment, people that they've deliberately decided to send over there. So, I mean, where are they going to get
these guys? They have almost 2,000 people in a rule of law mission in Kosovo, where there isn't enough work for 200.
Right.
You know, it's a matter of paying them enough, of providing the conditions that are required.
I'm not saying that these police don't exist. I'm just saying they've been unwilling to send them before. They've been unwilling to send them to Afghanistan. They've been unwilling to send them to Iraq. What's going to make them willing to send them into Libya? What's going to make them actually commit to the part that they've essentially signed up for?
There are two things. There's the threat of migration, which if Libya becomes chaotic, you can be damn sure a lot of Libyans are going to find their way to Italy. And the second reason is their own investments in oil and gas in Libya. And those pipelines, which float underneath the surface in the Mediterranean and supply a good deal of gas to Libya and Germany. I mean, the Mediterranean is their lake. It's not one of our great lakes. And they have to tend to this. And I would fault American diplomacy a little because I haven't seen the kind of, at least in public, I haven't seen the kind of pressure being brought on the Europeans on the civilian side of reconstruction in Libya that I've seen us bring on the Europeans on the military side. I mean, Gates made it very clear. He wanted them to step up and that we were stepping back. And that, in my way of thinking, was the right thing to do because their interests are more at risk. And we should expect them on the civilian side also to carry a very large part of the burden. I don't think the United States should get too deeply involved in this, but we should be ready to fill in now and again when things need to be filled in.
But, I mean, again, I keep coming back to this, that if – I mean, I would agree with you that from our perspective, Europe has an enormous stake, especially Southern Europe has an enormous stake in what happens in Libya, in particular Italy. But despite that, despite our belief in their stakes in this outcome, you've still seen, again, spearheaded by Italy, this great pullback and this unwillingness to kind of see it through. So, like, how do you think that the international community or maybe just the United States could then go about applying some kind of pressure to Italy that would actually convince them to put in their fair share of the war they voted for?
Well, you know, I spent 10 years as an American diplomat in Italy.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking you.
There's no substitute for a phone call from the President of the United States. During my time in Italy, to tell you the truth, they never refused us anything that the president had clearly asked for. And I think there is a need for some diplomacy at that level. I understand perfectly well that Mr. Berlusconi has other things on his mind and that Italy has other concerns, but I do believe that at the level of the president, the Italians just try very hard not to displease us. Why? Because there's that kind of connectedness and a sense of common interest as well. And in this case, it's not just common interest, it's Italian interest that's at issue. And, you know, if they weren't so distracted by the euro and the banks, I'm sure that they would be paying more attention. Mm. And we have to draw them back to paying a little attention to Libya, which in a very real historical sense is theirs.
Yeah.
And there's a very close connection there, not only through the colonial period, but after the colonial period as well. And I think the Italians owe it to themselves and owe it to Europe to step up here. They won't applaud me when I say that.
All right, so we're now looking at potentially a different Libya than what we had last week. What do you think is going to be the picture there in another 6 months? What do we have to look forward to there?
Oh, I think things will necessarily look less celebratory and more uncertain and difficult in 6 months.
Mm.
That's the pattern of all post-war periods, to go from enthusiasm and celebration to you know, you're doing this all wrong, everything's screwed up. But the truth of the matter is that as long as we can keep our eye on main targets, keeping the country unified, gradually pushing it in a more democratic direction, in the immediate term, maintaining law and order, not allowing privatization of state assets by pirates, basically, not allowing internecine warfare, not allowing revenge killing. If we've got a minimum of stability in 6 months, and an outline, a roadmap to new constitution, elections, the other key pieces of how you distribute power, I think that will be a good sign. But I don't expect people to be feeling euphoric in 6 months. They're going to be feeling enormously burdened by how difficult all this is.
So you'd say that the absolutely hardest part is what's staring us in the face right now?
I think, I won't say it's absolutely the hardest part, but if you can point the country in the right direction right now and get, you know, I know everybody tonight is worried about celebrating, but, you know, you have to get all those guns collected again. You gotta have people not walking around the streets with AK-47s. You know, there's a real need to reestablish law and order as soon as possible. And that doesn't mean that everything's perfect, but it means that an ordinary citizen can walk in the street and not fear major violence. He may have to fear getting murdered or robbed, but he doesn't have to fear one army, you know, kidnapping him, and, you know, another army, you know, doing something else to him. I mean, the major military operations have to end as quickly as possible now, and that's what Gaddafi is making so terribly hard by not formally turning over power. He's doing basically what Saleh has done in Yemen, and what Ali and Ben Ali and Mubarak did not do in Tunisia and Egypt. They turned over power, and it has improved the situation in both those places. If he continues to resist and continues to encourage his people to resist, it's going to bode very ill for the future.
Hmm. That's probably as good a place as any to call this off then and go to bed.
Well,
it's
a pleasure
PM.
Talking to you, and I follow you every day on Twitter. And
well, thanks. I follow you too.
I enjoy your the banter that goes on. I sometimes find it a little hard to follow, but I'm an old dog learning new tricks.
Well, I tremendously enjoy reading your work as well. So this was a real pleasure. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks. Take care.
I'm